Hello, I'm Oliver Wong, flying solo this week while Morgan is off on assignment. You are listening to Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, a record so red hot you could brand cattle with it, though we don't recommend that. Today, though, in honor of the symbolic end of summer, aka Labor Day, we wanted to revisit our summer music theme. So we asked today's guest, Alan Thayer, to talk about what he thinks is a perfect album to end the season. And for that, he suggested an LP as cool as ice, the self-titled 1973 album by bossa nova legend João Gilberto.
Foi você quem me ensinou que um homem como eu, que tem por quem chorar, só sabe o que é sofrer se o pranto se acabar.
In the aforementioned year of 1973, Gilberto entered a New Jersey studio, accompanied only by percussionist Sonny Carr, and together the two put together a minimalist masterpiece, what people commonly describe as Gilberto's equivalent to the Beatles' White Album. That's high praise. Gilberto took the bossa nova style he helped create and stripped it down to the barest of essences. Or as Andrew Kay wrote for his Worlds of Wanwood blog, the album becomes, quote, a set of whispered melodies endlessly repeated that settle into the brain and gesture towards eternity, unquote. Shout out to Blogspot bloggers coming with the killer turns of phrases there. For me, the end of summer is also about wistful melancholy, reflecting back on what could have been, but invariably never quite lives up to expectations. Yet in those waning days, we still hold on to that last wisp of hope that maybe at least the season sunset will leave us with some good vibes. And to that degree, this eponymous album delivers and then some.
Só querendo pedir, nunca soube o que é perder pra encontrar. Eu sei que é preciso.
As noted, this album was the pick of today's guest, DJ and author Alan Thayer, aka the Ambassador. Though he hails from the Pacific Northwest, Alan has made Brazil a second home over the years, and he's one of the most knowledgeable people in the States about Brazilian soul, funk, and jazz. Last year, he published a 33 1/3 book on Tim Maia's pair of spiritually inspired Brazilian soul albums, Rationale Volumes 1 and 2. He writes regularly for Wax Poetics, amongst other outlets, and if you dig his style, you can catch his weekly radio show, The Brazilian Beat, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on KHMD out of the Portland area. Alan, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thanks, Oliver. It's a pleasure to be here.
I hate to pigeonhole Brazilian music as being inherently summer-esque because I think that plays into stereotypes we have about the country, which are really just stereotypes I think we have of Rio de Janeiro, and Brazil is obviously a massive country, much bigger than just Rio. However, that all said, it's not like Brazilian genres like bossa nova and tropicalia didn't also purposely cultivate those associations with summers and beach and those kind of elements. My point being here is that in inviting you onto a summer, or specifically a end of summer themed episode, I certainly did have in the back of my head that as someone who is a Brazilian music expert and fanatic, you probably would not have a lot of difficulty coming up with a Brazilian album to fit into that. I guess the question here is why this João Gilberto album that fits into the idea of the end of summer for you?
Well, I think it goes back to just thinking of how I got into Brazilian music, and João Gilberto was really the gateway for me and for many people, I think. And so when I sort of got the question from you, to propose three albums,
yeah,
I ended up actually picking three, all from 1973,
yeah,
coincidentally, and all recorded in Rio de Janeiro. So I think to some degree, the Rio vibe, that summer vibe, comes from the fact that, like, you think in the U.S. you have New York and L.A. In Brazil, it's Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo. And yeah, Rio de Janeiro is the L.A.
Yeah.
of Brazil, in a sense. Culturally, it's on the beach. And I think what comes out of that reflects the lifestyle of the people living in Rio. And so while this album that we're talking about today wasn't recorded in Rio.
Yeah, in Jersey, which has its own summer vibe, just maybe a little bit different than we typically associate with Rio, but sure.
João Gilberto and the Bossa Nova movement really is synonymous with Rio. I mean, it has spread throughout the entire world, but you can't disconnect the origins of that genre from Rio de Janeiro and the beach, from Copacabana, from Ipanema, of course, the girl being from there.
Yeah.
And even the lyrics of that music initially was about the sun, flowers, beaches, the mountains. It was very poetic and wistful.
Ai, quando o samba acaba, eu fico triste então. Vai melancolia, eu quero alegria.
In choosing Gilberto, I mean, part of this too is he just passed away earlier this year at the venerable age of 88. And could you just give us, and I know this is a really unfair question, but like a capsule explanation of what made him so important to Brazilian music?
Sure, sure. I've been thinking about it a lot since he passed away, and even before that. Actually, I have only one Google saved search, and it's João Gilberto dead. And for some reason, I got in my mind a long time ago that I wanted to be aware of it when it happened. Maybe I wanted to write something about it, and
right.
I find we're doing this right now, so maybe it's fortuitous. But so I've thought a lot about his influence, and people have written about it extensively. There are three people who are credited for creating Bossa Nova: Antonio Carlos Jobim, who wrote most of the iconic songs; Vinicius G. Moraes, who wrote a lot of the iconic lyrics that went with a lot of those songs. But you can't have Bossa Nova without João Gilberto, because he was what you actually heard. He was the guitar style that he innovated, and the vocal style that he innovated. Before he came around, no one played like that, and nobody sang like that.
Mm.
So really, I mean, his revolution, the revolution that he introduced, was a soft revolution. It was a sort of a stepping back. And I think maybe it's relevant right now in these times when everything is sort of maxed out in terms of pop music.
Yeah.
It was similar in that time in Brazil, and people were singing really loudly and really boldly. So what he did was absolutely the opposite, and it had a dramatic effect on the rest of the history of Brazilian music, and I'd argue the history of popular music. You know, you wouldn't have Michelle by the Beatles. You wouldn't have any of those Burt Bacharach and Dionne Warwick tunes without Bossa Nova. I mean, it was so much ingrained with what was going on. So I think it's his particular style that he innovated more or less in isolation. He was taking elements, but he really sort of put something together that no one was doing at that time. And that became Bossa Nova. It happened to have some great songs. He didn't write many songs, so he can't take credit for that. But the style became something that was copied by all the other musicians in the scene. And Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, who came along later in Tropicália, all can identify exactly where they were when they first heard Chega de Saudade, which was the first song he released.
De ser milhões de abraços apertado assim, colado assim, calado assim, abraços e beijinhos e carinhos sem ter fim, que é pra acabar com esse negócio de viver longe de mim.
I realize this is also the first time we've ever had a discussion around, I think, really any Brazilian album, let alone specifically Bossa. So that moment, and this is a song that was recorded, I believe, in the late 1950s, is that in essence the birth of Bossa Nova, or was Bossa Nova a pre-existing genre style that João's influence then transformed?
No, it really started with him. There was a guy around that time who coined that term, Bossa Nova, and Bossa Nova really just means the new thing, Nova being new, and Bossa is sort of a thing. It's also been translated new wave.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, it was good marketing. Sounds nice. It's easy to pronounce for everyone, but it really doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Really?
It's just a new thing. Right.
It's just the new thing. It's
right.
The new thing.
Right.
And they were trying to put a name on something that João Gilberto was doing because it was so revolutionarily different. I mean, it was the kind of record that when the producers put it out, I mean, when it came out and was pressed up, there was no expectations that it would be big. And it wasn't until it started getting played on the radio that the reaction started coming in.
Mm.
And I was speaking with a famous Brazilian musician who lives in New York City named Dom Salvador. He's sort of been part of the Bossa Nova scene and on to the Brazilian soul and funk scene. Been living in New York for 50-some-odd years. We were just talking to him the other day, and he remembers exactly where he was in 1958 in his small town when he heard that record, and he went to his gig that night, and all of the other musicians could talk about nothing else other than this record. And that was repeated by nearly every influential or soon-to-be influential musician throughout Brazil. I think it's not overstated. It's yeah. like when people first heard Elvis. It's not uncommon, unlike that.
Mas se ela voltar, que coisa linda, que coisa louca. Pois há menos peixinhos a nadar no mar.
So what is it about this that was so revolutionary at the time? Like, why this album in that moment in the late 50s that caused all of these musicians across the country to be like, what the fuck is this?
It was something, I mean, it was so revolutionarily different in its sound. It was quiet. It had lots of jazz harmonies, mm-hmm. complex harmonies that weren't necessarily being sung before that. You know, Brazil's major musical tradition is samba. Like we think in the U.S., it might be blues in terms of sort of everything sort of builds off of that base. And bossa nova is a samba. It's an evolution of the samba. So it was still in tradition. It wasn't, you know, a radically different. It wasn't like rock when rock and roll came to Brazil and people were, you know, this is foreign influence. This was recognized as something domestic, but it was something entirely new. Mm. And I think it appealed to the youth in particular because, you know, this was not their parents' music.
Yeah.
And the sort of the big voiced sort of what we might think of as sort of mid-50s sort of big band era, Tony Bennett, big voice style vocals that were happening in Brazil, which is great stuff too. And very influential to João Gilberto, but he just didn't perform it that way.
Right. The artist that I really thought a lot about listening to this album that we've been talking about early job, but coming back to this 1973 album, is listening to it really reminded me a lot of Chet Baker.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my
They both have that, in essence, a very flat style, as you said, like in absence of vibrato in the voice, but also just the quietness of it. And stylistically, you could put a song off of this João album and combine that with something off of Chet Baker in that era, and the two, I think, would pair really beautifully. And now I kind of wonder, I didn't think to look up, when did Chet Baker record a lot of those classic ballads, and could he have been influenced by this? Because the similarities are so striking.
I mean, I've definitely heard Chet Baker come up in reference to the bossa nova, and I was rereading some of the materials that I know about João Gilberto, and I didn't find that particular reference, so yeah. I don't want to...
Right. Could just be a coincidence, of course, yeah.
But. Connected, but it is entirely true that the bossa nova as a genre form is really sort of, if you could take two genres and smash them together, it would be samba and West Coast jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So Chet being so much a part of that West Coast jazz scene, that influence is key. Stan Kenton is somebody who comes up a lot in terms of the arrangements and sort of the, and again, I'm not a musician, so I'm not going to speak eloquently about, you know, musical techniques and styles, but what I think the sophisticated harmonies that Stan Kenton introduced in his orchestras were highly influential to Jobim, João Donato, and these guys were all in the mix with João Gilberto early in coming up with this new style.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think that's a great way of thinking about it, which is you take some of the bossa influences, but then you mash it up with what's going on with West Coast jazz, especially with the guitar playing of that. The irony, if one even wants to call it an irony, being that Brazil and specifically Rio is on the East Coast, so you have this kind of bicoastal fusion happening, two different continents, of course, but that produces such a particular kind of distinctive style into itself.
But it's also interesting to note that combination between Rio and LA wasn't new. I mean, Carmen Miranda was living in Los Angeles at that time, you know, in the 40s and 50s. And, you know, that famous Disney film, Saludos Amigos. I don't know if you remember the Joe Carioca was this, you know, a parrot that goes down to Brazil. And
okay.
Orson Welles is in the mix. And
yeah.
We've all seen it at some point.
Right.
And, you know, he gets drunk on cachaça and sambas. Yeah. And
Oh.
Brasil lindo e trigueiro.
You know, there's been a connection between LA and Rio for quite a while, but I think really at that time there's a well documented scene in Rio of young musicians, you know, rabidly listening to imported records, jazz records in particular, yeah, or whoever could buy it, and then they'd, you know, find a turntable and listen together because only one person could afford the record kind of situation.
Yeah.
And that became hugely influential in what ended up becoming Bossa Nova. Mm.
Bringing things here back to the present of the album here, right, 1973. So by this time, you know, Zhao's already become world famous. Bossa Nova has become well established. So where exactly is he in his own career in 73? And especially, what takes him to New Jersey to record this album of all places?
So João basically stayed in the U.S. after the success of Gets Gilberto, so the famous album that came out in 1964 with the girl from Ipanema. Mm-hmm. It made him a worldwide star, and it allowed him to basically stay in the U.S. And also consider that in 1964 was when the democratically elected president was toppled by a coup, again, like many coups in Latin America, supported by the United States of America and CIA. And what started in 1964 and ended in 1985 was a military dictatorship. So a lot of musicians thought it might be better to sort of stay out, stay away if they could. And João Gilberto and Antonio Carlos Jobim are the sort of the classic examples of those musicians who were doing well enough financially that they could afford to sort of, you know, live and work outside of the U.S. But João's different than Jobim in so many ways. Jobim went on a tear and recorded like 10 albums in, you know, 4 years. One of them was Frank Sinatra. Lots of classic albums. João Gilberto recorded, let's see, between Gets Gilberto and this album in 73, he recorded one other album in 1970 in Mexico. And so he was an artist that really was not motivated by fame in any notable way, really. From all the documentation I've read, he only really worked professionally in the sense of getting money. He was constantly playing music. He would only do gigs and record basically when he needed money to pay the bills and to support his family, even though he was very modest in that regard. And that's what brings us to New Jersey in a way, in that he was living between New York. He spent a couple years in Mexico around the time he recorded the album in Mexico, and New Jersey. And so it was probably not far from where he was living.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story of him and his then wife, a woman by the name of Miucha, who's a well-known musician as well, who passed away just this past year also.
Mm-hmm.
They shared an apartment or a house in New Jersey. And it was when they moved in, they only had a table. And so instead of buying furniture, they did as many New Yorkers would do, go out and see what the neighbors left out on the curb. And so furnished, you know, this is one of the most famous musicians in the world, you know, to some regard. You know, furnishing his apartment, you know, with trash. And so I think why he recorded in New Jersey, why he decided to record in 1973 to make this album is still pretty much a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so glad that he did, because this for me is, I mean, I could have picked a lot of different João Gilberto albums, but this one sort of raises above just a little bit above the others. And I think the reason why is he had stumbled upon sort of the perfect mix and was able to record it without the influence, I think, of sort of producers and other people telling him what else should be on the record. So the fact that it was just him, his guitar, his voice, and Sonny Carr, and then his wife, Miucha, joins on one guest vocal on Isaura. It actually predates what he ended up doing the rest of his life, sort of beginning in the 80s. He never recorded with any backup instrumentation after that.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, how unusual was this super stripped down style compared to what you might have gotten from other notable Brazilian bossa nova artists in that same era?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you think of his closest comparison would be Jobim. Antonio Carlos Jobim, sometimes known as Tom Jobim. And Jobim was recording for A&M. He was recording for CTI. He was even doing some recordings down in Brazil under Brazilian labels. And Jobim, being an arranger, and I don't know if he conducted, but he arranged very complex music with, 30 different musicians. Yeah. And they couldn't be more stark in some ways.
Yeah.
So in Antonio Carlos Jobim's version of Aguas de Março, Waters of March, which kicks off this album, is so radically different in terms of the instrumentation. It's almost unrecognizable, except for the song is so iconic. It just jumps off of out of the speakers. So it was totally different than anything else that was going on. Mm. And I think it's really curious. I think you pointed this out, when you asked me to send you the sound files. It's not on any streaming services, is it?
No.
And it was not released in the U.S. at that time on vinyl. And so I don't know if that was decided that there just wasn't a market for it, but it was recorded for the Brazilian audience and got some, I think, a French release as well.
Yeah.
So I don't think anyone expected it to be, runaway hit.
And I think it'd be worth to put this into perspective, that difference in style. So why don't we first take a listen to Jobim's version of The Waters of March, which is kind of a bossa classic. So that was Jobim's version of The Waters of March, and then let's take a listen to what Zhao does on this album. The thing is, I knew going into this album that it was going to be very stripped down in terms of it's just the barest of instrumentation. And I don't know if it's because I just associate the sound of bossa. It still sounds like a bossa album, right? So it's not like it feels like you're listening to an entire different genre. And in a way, I feel like my mind fills in all of the rest of the instrumentation, which isn't literally physically there, but yet this doesn't sound as sparse as some other album or some other genre, which might just be a single instrument that you hear. And I don't know what that is. Again, maybe it's just I'm bringing all of this audio memory into this with me just because I know what Waters of March sounds like and I'm expecting something that has that thicker arrangement, as you were saying. But for something as minimalist as this, it doesn't actually feel that minimalist. And I can't really explain that paradox.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to compare it to, say, a folk song, an American traditional folk song, voice and guitar,
yeah,
that feels very spare, a Pete Seeger or what have you.
Right.
And this is literally, the same. Some of the songs on this album are just him with guitar and voice.
Right.
There's no Sonny Carr in the mix
right
at all.
Absolutely.
And I think the thing that's worth noting, and maybe this is what you're hearing, is what João Gilberto is doing on guitar, and this is the style, this is what makes his style so revolutionary, is that he took the idea of the samba, and the samba at its core is drums. And so it's a sort of a layering of different drums and
right,
different rhythms.
Right.
Batucada is one of the forms, and he plays it on the guitar. And again, I'm not a guitar player. I don't know exactly what he's doing, but you hear it, and that sort of fills out the sound because he's playing the melody, but he's also playing it percussively.
Oh.
So you're hearing the drums being played by the guitar.
Yeah.
And that's literally the thing that everyone knew that maybe we could figure out how to sing the way that he's singing.
Right.
Because that seemed pretty straightforward. But the guitar style that he brought that was so revolutionary, confounded all of his peers, and they literally, hold up in their apartments in their homes trying to figure out how to play the way that he was doing,
yeah,
and contorting their fingers in a way to, play, the beat on one string and the melody on the other. And what's also interesting, and I think what creates that dynamic tension in his music, is that he's playing one rhythm while singing a different rhythm. So there's two different speeds going on at the same time.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to talking more about the specific songs off of this album. But first, we're going to take a break to listen to some of our Sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Listen. Listen, I'm a hotshot Hollywood movie producer. You have until I finish my glass of kombucha to pitch me your idea. Go.
All right, it's called Who Shot Ya? A movie podcast that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes. I'm Iffy Whiteyway, the new host of the show and a certified BBN.
BBN?
Buff black nerd.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, an elderly gay and legit film critic who wrote a book on Christmas movies.
I'm Drea Clark, a loud white lady from Minnesota.
Each week, we talk about a new movie in theaters and all the important issues going on in the film industry.
It's like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner meets Cruising.
And if it helps seal the deal, I can flex my muscles while we record each episode.
I'm sorry, this is a podcast? I'm a movie producer. How did you get in here?
Iffy, quick, start flexing.
Bicep, lats, chest. Who Shot Ya? Dropping every Friday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Dave Hill from Show Business. And while I'm not from Canada, my grandfather Clarence Vincent Blake Sr. was, and he wouldn't shut up about it. My grandfather moved on to that great penalty box in the sky way back in the 80s. Still, all these years later, I can't help but wonder, what do we really know about Canada and its people? Which is why my friend Chris Gersbeck and I decided to make So, You're Canadian. Brand new podcast from the Maximum Fun Network, on which I attempt to get to know our neighbors to the north, one Canadian at a time. Coming to Maximum Fun, August 27th. And I'm not sorry.
And we are back here on Heat Rocks, talking with DJ and author Alan Thayer about the self-titled 1973 stripped down bossa nova album by João Gilberto. Alan, before we get back to João, can you tell us a little bit, how did you get interested in Brazilian music? As I mentioned earlier, you grew up in the Northwest, Portland, the Portland area these days is where you call home. So how did someone from the Northwest get interested in music from the South Atlantic?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And it wasn't necessarily a straight line, but I can trace it back to a couple different things. And a shout out to Luaka Bop for their very iconic compilation that David Byrne put together. And I want to say 1989, it's called Beleza Tropical. My dad had that CD, and we would listen to that. Now, João Gilberto is not there at all, but it sort of sparked something for me, for sure. And then if you recall, in the mid-90s, there was sort of a lounge revival thing going on.
Right.
And so with CD reissues and compilations coming out, I remember sort of getting into a little bit of that, and Girl from Ipanema being sort of one of the most iconic tunes that I don't think represents lounge, but gets sort of lumped in,
sure,
you know, sort of came to my attention. And then what really sealed the deal for me was my dad was on a business trip down to Rio, and he came back with a stack of CDs. And one of them was by Gilberto Gil, who came from the Tropicália scene and is a devotee of João Gilberto as well. And it was his Unplugged album. So the whole Unplugged thing went down to Brazil too. And he sort of re-recorded a lot of his classic tunes that I'd never heard of at that time in a more stripped down style.
Pessoas até muito mais vão lhe amar, até muito mais difíceis que eu pra você.
And I remember listening to that, and at the same time, I was getting into the back catalog of soul and funk music in the US. And I remember having this moment of listening to Stevie Wonder and then putting on the Gilberto Gil and being like, these are kind of the same. There's a lot going on that's very similar. And the chasm between the US and Brazil got really small all of a sudden. And I just sort of went down a wormhole there. And then once I got into collecting vinyl, as you can relate to, my niche became Brazilian music. And I just sort of went for it. And then I guess to sort of bring it to where I sort of decided to take it professional, if as it were, was reading Wax Poetics when it first started coming out and thinking I wanted to be part of this. I want to be part of this somehow, but what would I write about?
Yeah.
I considered myself a writer, though I hadn't been published very, very many places at that time. And it occurred to me that, well, I'm really into this Brazilian thing. Maybe I can say something intelligent about that.
Yeah.
And I ended up pitching Umair Deodato and an interview with him, who happened to live in New York. I lived in New York, got an interview, and it sort of, I felt good. So I kind of just kept going with that and learned Portuguese, went down to Brazil a number of times, and found myself, you know, in the mix.
Yeah. Just to spin back real quick, I was thinking you were talking about the comps and anthologies that we were coming across in the early 90s, which sparked a memory for me because working at the college radio station, which is where I got my start as a DJ, this is in the early mid-90s, I remember, was it the Blue Note Brazil series? I thought was probably one of my
Blue
first.
Blue Brazil,
yeah. Exactly, was one of my first introductions. And there was another, I think, really influential anthology series. And unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the series, but I'm sure you probably remember it because each of them had a very colorful VW bug was on the cover of it.
Yeah, the Glücklich, was that the?
Yeah.
It was basically like German takes on European versions of Brazilian influenced tunes,
right?
And sort of basically started unfolding the diaspora of Brazilian music through these comps and such. And you really have to shout out the Europeans and the Japanese to some extent for reintroducing this music in the CD era and sort of creating a narrative around it. And, you know, shout out to Giles Peterson and Joe Davis and the labels in the UK that were compiling this stuff. I mean, the first couple of comps I listened to were Blue Brazil, which I forget who comped that one, but then the Brazilica series that Giles Peterson put together. I mean, it just went, you went from surface level to super deep in a matter of moments.
Right, right. Partly to this point, too, is the kind of cross-pollination of how Brazilian music, you could hear those influences in the States, but of course, the other way around, which is how American soul and funk and jazz styles were also very heavily influencing the Rio and Sao Paulo and other Brazilian music scenes. Just such a fertile conversation seemed to be happening between these places.
Absolutely. And I've been thinking a lot lately about how, again, the connection between LA and Brazil. You think of a lot of the music that was coming out of the US on the West Coast in the 70s. It was buried in there, but there's a lot of Brazilian influence that you can't really avoid. Earth, Wind, and Fire. You just had Rafael Sadiq in the studio.
Yeah, right, right.
And you can hear even on Rolling Stones, their big disco hit, there's a cueca in that song. That squeaking, sort of honking percussion instrument.
Yeah.
You can hear, and I mean, that is only a Brazilian instrument. It doesn't come from anywhere else. And you hear it on, you know, George Duke records. You hear it on all kinds of records. Sarah Vaughan has a record with Marcos Valle doing the arrangements from the 70s. But it wasn't necessarily on the surface. They weren't advertised as Brazilian records. They weren't, you know, it wasn't, there wasn't some tie-in necessarily. But I think of the 70s as an era where it was hard to avoid the Brazilian influence in a lot of pop music.
Yeah. Bringing this back to 1973 and bringing this back to João Gilberto's album here, how did he end up choosing the songs that he ended up recording on here?
I think that's one of the reasons why I love this album so much is that the song selection is really, I mean, there's not a bad song on here.
Yeah.
And they're all different enough. And if you know a little bit of the context, it's even more interesting. So, you know, Waters of March was a very new song at the time. I think it had been first recorded in 1972. So this came out the very next year.
Yeah.
And I think even Jobim's version came out this same year. So that was sort of, you know, the new hotness, in a sense, that he was bringing to the table. And everything else really is from the past or something that he brought to the table and recorded. And it is true that he did not write many of his own songs. But that's also why this album is interesting, because there are two originals of his, and I think he probably has less than 10 original compositions in his, you know, seven decade career. So it's notable that he has a few. And what I love about his original songs is that they're really not about the lyrics whatsoever. I mean, A2, Un Dieu is literally just a hummed melody, yeah, or sort of a sung melody.
Yeah.
I'm no singer, and I have two children, and this was the only song I would attempt to sort of lullaby them to sleep, because one, you don't need to remember any words, and it's just kind of a perfect lullaby. I heard you humming it right as we started before this recording.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets stuck in your head.
It really does.
And it's so beautiful.
It does feel like a lullaby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very hypnotic in its particular way. Not to turn you into Portuguese native informant here, but what is that? What does the title mean?
I have no idea. I don't think it actually means anything.
Okay.
And so his other famous songs from his very first, his first run, basically from 58 to 61 is when he recorded three albums that sort of defined the bossa nova canon. He's got two originals out of those. And one is called Bim Bom, and one's called Oba La La. And Bim Bom and Oba La La don't mean anything. They're literally just onomatopoeic sounds,
yeah,
that sort of fit what he was doing.
It's like Phil Collins with Susu Studio.
Yes. Perfect. Exactly like that. Love that too. I want to hear João Gilberto doing Susu Studio now.
That was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, it really was. You think of what really makes João Gilberto unique is he's sort of like, you know, Bossa Nova Buddha. He's sort of meditating, and it's almost like, you know, a chant. It's almost like his songs are incantations. It's sounds, because the vocals are, of course, important, but sounds that fit the music.
Yeah.
And it's not important what the words are.
Yeah.
And so he's got Un Dieu, and then he's also got, what's the other one he does on this one?
Valsa.
Valsa.
Yeah.
And with the subtitle Bebel. And so Bebel being Bebel Gilberto. Some of you might have heard from her run, and she's still going and representing Bossa Nova to some degree. So she was the daughter of Miúcha and João Gilberto, who had been born in, I think, 1966.
Okay.
And so was a little girl at that time.
Right.
And that one doesn't have any words to it, if I'm not mistaken, either.
That's so beautiful.
I mean, he could just do that stuff all day long.
Yeah.
It sounds intolerable to hear the idea of listening to a performer play the same song for 8 hours on end, except for maybe João Gilberto. I think I might be able to tolerate that and even, you know, consider it an honor. I wish I could have had that opportunity.
Yeah.
I did actually get to see him twice perform live, which is, I think, a pretty, I mean, it's, I'm so thankful that I was able to do that and that I took the opportunity when I had very little money in college to buy a ticket from Washington, D.C., by Greyhound to Carnegie Hall, you know, spending money I had to go see him twice.
Yeah.
And so memorable. And, you know, you just wish the show would keep going. Mm. But thinking of other songs on this record, there's some classics in terms of Brazilian classics.
Yeah.
So the third track, Na Baixa do Sapateiro, which, if I have my translation right, means sort of underneath the shoe repair shop. So
okay.
I guess you kind of imagine, you know, the basement of the cobblesmith, right?
Yeah.
The cobbler. And this is a song by Ari Barroso, who is, you know, top three Brazilian songwriters up there with sort of, if you were a Cole Porter of Brazil type character. And this one has lyrics, but he does it as an instrumental here. And this is a song that he was known to sort of obsess about for decades. So I was just reading his backstory again. And he was obsessing about this song in the early 60s. But this is his only studio recording of it. João Gilberto is the kind of artist that when his albums came out, you know, he was beloved by musicians. So he was a musician's musician.
Yeah.
And his albums come out, the first thing people would look at is, oh, what songs did he do? You know, and hopefully he did one of mine. I mean, that's like, you could put that on your tombstone. João Gilberto recorded my song.
Ah.
And so he would record some well-known ones, like Na Baixa do Sapateiro is, you know, a household name song. But then he would do something like É Preciso Perdoar from the side B that, you know, I don't know that anyone's, you know, who else has ever recorded that song, but he sort of retrieved that from the back corners of his memory.
Yeah.
Some old recording that he had heard and decided to sort of bring that to the table.
So, Alan, it's obviously, you love this album, right? You know so much about each of these songs. So I'm going to ask you a very difficult question. If you had to pick a single fire track off of here, what would it be? What is the favorite
jam? It's tough, but I can't not go with Águas de Março because it's...
Interesting.
It's... People have often asked me, this question comes up, I'm sure, for you.
Yeah.
You know, people know you as a music person. What's your favorite song? What's your favorite album?
Sure.
And you got to come up with something, typically.
Right. I always hate that question.
Oh, I know. Me too. But it kind of forces you to, like, choose your favorite child, you know?
Yeah.
And Waters of March is a song that I've often gone to when asked that question. Mm. And I've sort of changed which version, because there's the version with Antonio Carlos Jobim and Elis Regina, where they do a duet that's really magical. But I think over time, this is the version that really sticks with me.
O caco de vidro, a vida é o sol. É a noite, é a morte, é o laço, é o anzol. São as águas de março, fechando o verão. É a promessa de vida no teu coração.
Why the song in general? And specifically, what is it? And we talked a little bit about the version on this album. But what is it about the song that resonates with you?
You know, I'm not entirely certain. It's almost like the magic of music on some level, what appeals to you. And I was already into Brazilian music at the time that I first came across this song, and it was on some Brazilian compilation that I heard the Jobim and Elis Regina version. And it has this certain sort of bounce to it. The flow of the lyrics, and again, not as a musician, I can't tell you exactly what's happening and what makes it so magical. But the sort of the cadence of the song, you know, it's very poetic once you hear the English version of it. And what's notable, too, about the English version is that Antonio Carlos Jobim wrote the lyrics, which he was not known for writing lyrics, but he wrote them both in English and in Portuguese. He did his own translation. And so it talks about, you know, sort of the changing of the seasons and sort of the simplicity of life, you know, a rock, a stone, a bird, which sounds kind of, you know, overly simple, but it's also, when paired with this beautiful music and these wonderful melodies, it just, you know, it just elicits, you know, the glory of being alive and, you know, being outside and, you know, witnessing nature. And I don't know, I'm sounding corny, but
no, I totally feel you. I think with this song in particular, too, in the versions that I've heard, the things that they all share in common is the way in which the lyrics are meant to be sung has a very distinct percussive flow to it, too, right? It's choppy, but not in like a disjunctive way, but, you know, there's a particular kind of meter and rhythm to it, which I think adds part of what makes it so memorable.
And now I'm listening to it again as we just played it, and if I'm not mistaken, it doesn't really have a chorus to it. It just sort of keeps flowing.
Right.
And the lyrics, the Waters of March, as Águas de Março, just sort of appear within the same flow. And so it has this, I mean, not to get, you know, the metaphorical here, but it's the Waters of March. It sounds like a stream flowing, right?
Okay.
It just keeps going.
Yeah, yeah.
So trickling along.
It was hard for me to figure out what I thought would be the fire track for myself. And partly I think it's because the minimalism of the album is so many of the songs in a way kind of blend together so that you experience the album not necessarily as, I think, was it 10 discrete tracks, but really as just one long listening experience. Within that, though, I think what I ended up landing on was a song that I think, for me at least, melodically was one of the tunes that stuck to me the most, which is Eu Vim da Bahia.
Onde a gente não tem pra comer, mas de fome não morre, porque na Bahia tem mande manjar de outro lado, Senhor do Bom Fim.
And seriously, if you were to ask me tomorrow what my favorite song is, I might have picked something else, but this is the one I'm sticking with, at least from right now. I think I also like the fact that the song title, if I have this right, translates into I Came From Bahia, which is, of course, where Zhao is, though he didn't write the song. This is Gilberto Gil, who I'm assuming also probably came from Bahia.
Correct.
So I like that it's rapping for the hood.
Absolutely. And there's two songs about Bahia on this album. So there's Ovinda Bahia, and then there's also Falsa Baiana, which means fake Bahian, which was a sort of a classic tune before, and he sort of reintroduced it into the sort of the popular canon.
Baiana que entra no samba só fica parada, não canta, não samba, não mole nem nada, não sabe deixar a mocidade louca. Baiana é aquela que entra no samba de qualquer maneira, que mexe, remexe.
If you had to pick a favorite moment off this album, what would it be? And one of my favorite moments was the beginning of a Valsa, which is when they put, and I thought it was a slight delay, but listening to the clip that we heard earlier, I think it might be that they're overdubbing his voice. But either way, you have that slight echo effect. And this is already an album that has, I think, a very dreamlike presence, but taking that vocal effect really, really amplifies that sense of you're just in this, drifting through this dream. So, Alan, how about you? Do you have a favorite moment on this album?
Yeah, no, I've been listening to the podcast, so I prepped for this one. Where is it on my notes? I found it. So Eu Quero Samba, which is a song we haven't talked about yet. I Want a Samba is how that translates. And right in the middle of it at 2:40, he does this vocal thing that slays me every time.
Something about that, his way that he used that Z sound.
Yeah. And it's
slightly,
and again,
nasal. Yeah.
There's no words there. It is gobbledygook. It's sung in the most beautiful way. And, and that's something I love about Brazilian music is that the scatting that they do is a different vocabulary than the scatting in the U.S.
Right.
So there's a lot of ba-da ba-da ba-das and a lot of za-za-zas and things like that that you just don't hear from, Ella and the classic scatters of the American jazz tradition.
Yeah.
And it just feels fresh and it feels almost childlike in a way. And I don't mean that in a diminutive way, but, it's almost like, a toddler's, babble.
Right, right. If there was a song off here that you would want to hear a contemporary artist take on, cover, remix, etc., what song would it be and who would you want to take it on?
Ooh. Let's see. If I'm thinking of maybe a non-Brazilian artist, it might be fun to do one that doesn't have Portuguese lyrics so they can kind of, not have to stumble over that kind of stuff because it's always a little awkward.
Right.
So Valsa might be, I could imagine some beautiful versions of Valsa. I'd say Undiu, but I just can't imagine someone doing it as well as he does.
Right.
So
maybe
it's almost like
blasphemous to have someone else.
Yeah,
do it.
Right, exactly. So Valsa, and let me think who might be good at that. A name that comes to mind, and this person isn't sadly with us anymore, but whose vocal style I've been thinking about as maybe he listened to João Gilberto, or maybe he didn't, but Elliot Smith. And I know this is totally incongruous, but
no, I could totally hear that. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, his masterful guitar work and his vocals, which are, very belabored also in a way that he wanted a very particular vocal sound on his records. And it's not dissimilar to João Gilberto's.
I think what we really need though is a death metal version of Undo.
That might be the only way to do it.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I'd listen to that. I'd listen to that. And I don't even like metal.
Well, as someone who listens to the show, you know what question's coming next, which is, if you had to describe this album in three words, what would that trio be?
Oh, I've been thinking about this a little bit, and I think I'm going to go with voice, guitar, perfection.
Mm. Very clean. I like that. If you like today's album that we focused on, the João Gilberto 1973 self-titled LP, we have some recommendations for other things you might want to check out. I would recommend Third Wave's Here and Now, which is a relatively obscure jazz album, vocal jazz album from the late 1960s, recorded on, I believe it's the German label MPS, but featuring a quintet of Pinay sisters from Stockton, California, who were discovered and then produced by the great George Duke. This was their one and only album. It's tough to find the original versions, but it's been reissued a couple of times. So again, the group is Third Wave. I don't know if they do any specifically bossa or Brazilian specific songs, but I feel like the feel of it seems very much influenced by it. And you especially hear that on the very first song of the album, which is called Waves Lament. And just beautiful multi-voice harmony. It's a pity this group never managed to get past, you know, just that first album. But again, that's Third Wave's Here and Now, which you can find on reissue. Alan, what would you recommend people if they really love the João Gilberto album? Where should they go next?
Can I do two?
Yeah.
All right. So from the past, I would point to Caetano Veloso's first record before Tropicália really became a thing. His first record is a duet record with Gal Costa, who also was part of that Tropicália scene. And you really get a sense of how much they were all indebted to bossa nova, because it's basically a bossa nova record. It's called Domingo from 1967. So Caetano Veloso and Gal Costa together. Cada palma em guarada tem que estar quieta. My second choice is a brand new record, and I wanted to bring attention to this artist that goes by the name of Sessa, S-E-S-S-A. Came out just this year in 2019. The album's called Grandeza, and it's impossible to ignore the João Gilberto and bossa nova vibe, but it also has a lot of sort of more Afro-Brazilian traditions going on. It has a sort of a mystical feel, and I think that the João Gilberto would appreciate sort of the mysticism in this record. Azul tão profundo amor. Que me despertou domingo. Os filhos de Gandhi mostram. That will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Alan Thayer. Don't forget, you can pick up his 33 and a third book about another Brazilian master, Tim Maia, for his Rationale Volumes 1 and 2. Alan, what are you working on now? I'm in the mix trying to come up with some new things to write. I've been sort of working this Tim Maia book for quite a while and really been enjoying that. But, you know, the opportunity to talk about someone other than Tim Maia was welcome at this point. So thinking about some other things, I have my radio show that I do weekly. I'm on the verge of threatening to do a Brazilian music podcast, trying to sort of put that together. But, I'm putting all my stuff on a website, alanthayer.com, A-L-L-E-N-T-H-A-Y-E-R.
Yeah.
And so you can see some of my Wax Poetics writing, some mixes I've put together, and maybe a link to my book.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, Oliver. It's been awesome.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. One last thing. Here is a teaser from next week's episode, which is my conversation with music writer and critic Lorraine Ali talking about MIA's sophomore album, Kala. Why Kala? What makes that particular sophomore album a heat rock for you?
I think Kala was just a better album. I think she had really gotten into her own sort of groove, so to speak, with Kala. And, you know, she had been with Diplo before with Arular, and it was interesting, but people had given him a ton of credit for that. We can get into that later.
Oh, we are definitely going to get into that. Yeah.
Imagine that. They're giving the white guy all the credit. That's crazy. But I felt like Kala, when that came out, it was Arula realized in much more depth.
Yeah.
But it also kind of also went wider. It was weirder, but it was also bigger. I mean, it was amazing kind of how she was able to go much more specific, and in doing that, make it much wider. It was also more focused just in terms of being topical.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it really hit on things that were happening at the time in a way that Arular was much more scattered and kind of much more about like a dance club experience.
Right.
Kala seemed to be a mix of that, but also, you know, kind of a topical roadmap of what was happening around the world.
Mm.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.